From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, patience by name, but not by nature. Nigeria's First Lady orders the arrest of an activist protesting the government's failure to rescue 300 kidnapped schoolgirls. Here, pressure is mounting on the Obama administration to help find them.
This should have been all over the press in every capacity, just as much as the flight, just as much as everything that's happening in the Ukraine.
Also today, marking the 20th anniversary of South Africa's democracy in California, mourning the death of one of the world's top tennis players, and an exclusive interview with chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov about the turmoil in his homeland, Russia.
What Putin did in Crimea, it opens Pandora box.
That's ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From feature story news in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. More than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls remain missing more than 3 weeks after they were abducted by the extremist group Boko Haram, which says they plan to sell the girls off. As both the Nigerian and U.S. governments come under criticism for not doing enough to find the kidnappees, activists on the ground are demanding more information from authorities and more attention from the global media. Ngozi Ezi is the director of the Nigerian chapter of Women for Women International.
We want to believe that we'll find the girls and that it will not make people not to want to send their girls to school. One of the reasons of sending girls to school is to ensure that we also have a peaceful society. Because if you come to the area of politics, you'll find out that women are underrepresented.
Pro-Russian militants have killed 4 Ukrainian soldiers, injured 30 others, and shot down another army helicopter near the eastern city of Slovyansk, according to authorities in Kiev. There are also casualties within the rebel group, which has reportedly retreated after government forces regained control of a TV tower in the city suburbs. Moscow denies accusations from Ukraine and the U.S., among others, that they are backing the armed separatists. The World Health Organization is warning that the wild polio virus is back and threatening to cause an international health crisis. A new report from the WHO found that adults are carrying the virus from countries where the disease has not been eradicated back to places where it previously had been wiped out. Priscilla Huff reports.
The World Health Organization is warning the spread of wild polio virus is threatening the eradication of one of the most easily preventable diseases. The new report highlights that adults are carrying the virus from Pakistan to Afghanistan, from Syria to Iraq, and from Cameroon to Equatorial Guinea, all conflict regions. They are urging these and other countries such as Nigeria, where vaccination campaigns have hit roadblocks, to announce national health emergencies and to rededicate efforts to vaccine campaigns.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that local governments can open meetings with explicitly religious prayers. But critics of the 5-4 split decision say it violates the principles of the U.S. Constitution, where church and state are kept separate. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The case relates to the town of Greece in New York State, which has been hosting a Chaplain of the Month for several years. Though the town's government invited other denominations, the prayer leader in practice is almost always Christian. Writing for the court's majority opinion of 5-4, Justice Kennedy described it as a ceremonial prayer that reflects the traditions of government since the founding of the country. But one of the dissenters, Justice Kagan, said the practice violated the Constitution's promise that every citizen, irrespective of her religion, owns an equal share of her government. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Syria's main Western-backed opposition group will be making its case on Capitol Hill this week, lobbying the U.S. to provide it with more weaponry in a fresh bid to bring down the Assad regime. The president of the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces, Ahmed Jarba, is also expected to meet top U.S. administration officials. And a new round of nuclear talks are set to begin Tuesday in New York between Iran and the 5 permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, plus Germany. The P5 plus one group, comprising the U.S., Russia, China, Great Britain, and France plus Germany, will meet with Iran to discuss Tehran's nuclear energy program. And new information shows that American spending on healthcare in the first quarter of this year rose at the fastest pace since 1980. Analysts say the sharp increase has been prompted by the Affordable Care Act, which has led many more people to visit doctors and hospitals. Here's Lorna Shattuck.
Healthcare expenditure in the U.S. climbed at an annual rate of 9.9% last quarter. That's according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. The figures are up from 5.6% in the fourth quarter of 2013, the biggest jump since late 1980. Those higher health outlays even helped prop up a generally weak U.S. economy, which would actually have shrunk if not for the surge in health-related spending. Analysts say most of the increase is down to the roughly 8 million Americans who've signed up for the Affordable Care Act. Lorna Shattuck, Washington.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
It should be on the front top of every single news bulletin until they are found, because it's that kind of attention that stirs the politicians to do something.
The HBO star James Purefoy talking in London over the weekend about the need to keep the plight of 300 kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls uppermost in the minds of the public and of policymakers. Well, today, video emerged of the Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram for the first time admitting that it had seized the girls last month as they made their way to sit exams in a local school. And in that video, one of the group's leaders vowed to sell the girls on the open market. Meanwhile, in an extraordinary turn of events, a woman who has helped organise protests on behalf of the girls' families was arrested in Nigeria after a meeting with the country's First Lady, Patience Jonathan. The First Lady was reportedly impatient over the fact that the activist came to see her, not the mothers of the girls she'd invited. Here in Washington, the Obama administration is determining what level of assistance to offer the Nigerian government as the White House comes under growing pressure to provide at least as much attention to the plight of the girls as it did to the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines jet. FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
Boko Haram has claimed responsibility for the April abduction of more than 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria. In a nearly hour-long video obtained by the French news agency AFP. Standing in front of an armored vehicle with a gun strapped across his chest, the extremist leader Abubakar Shekau explained why they carried out the attack.
I have kidnapped a girl from a school with Western education, and that bothers you. I say that Western education must end. It must end. The girls must leave and get married.
At a press conference in Ethiopia this weekend, Secretary of State John Kerry called the kidnapping an unconscionable crime and said the U.S. government will do everything possible to rescue the young women and hold the perpetrators to justice. Though State Department counterterrorism expert Tina Kadenow reiterated this vow of assistance, she did not specify how exactly the U.S. government is helping and instead emphasized the Nigerian government's responsibility.
I think it's very important that the government of Nigeria, which recognizes the nature of the threat, continue to address this as a holistic matter. In other words, it can't just be a military and security effort. It has to be an effort that undertakes a variety of different efforts, which includes, by the way, development of that part of Nigeria where Boko Haram tends to be more active.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan said this weekend that his government is doing everything it can to locate and rescue the girls, and in turn blamed their parents for not cooperating fully with police. These grief-stricken families and their supporters have been protesting for weeks in the Nigerian capital of Abuja.
We are saddened, we are anxious for their safety. The whole country is like standing on standby, waiting to see what will happen.
That's Ngozi Eze, the director of the Nigerian chapter of Women for Women International. She says the government has not been forthcoming about what they know about the missing girls and what's being done to bring them home.
There's been a lot of rumors that they've been taken maybe across the border to Chad as well as Cameroon. And there's also fear that they are being led into like the forest, the Zambia forest. So we don't know. The rumors is that they've been married off They are being used as sex slaves.
With the Nigerian government and military coming under pressure for their failure so far to find the missing teenagers, and the U.S. government making only vague offers of assistance, communities around the world have taken to both the internet and the streets to pressure leaders to do more. More than 250,000 people have signed an online petition demanding world leaders support efforts to rescue the girls and ensure that all schools are protected from future attacks. Activists have also used the Twitter hashtags #BringBackOurGirls and #WhereAreOurGirls to raise awareness and organize actions, such as a protest outside D.C.'s Nigerian embassy on Tuesday. But the search has received little attention from the Western mainstream media and political leaders, even those who repeatedly tout their dedication to human rights in Africa. Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown blasted this tepid response in an interview on BBC Newsnight.
And if this had happened in Europe or America, people would be up in arms demanding action and knowing that there was something that we could do to help these girls. Now, I would like to see some air support given internationally so that they can scan the jungle area, the forest area, to see if we can find these girls.
As days go by without progress, many in Nigeria and around the world are voicing concern that if the girls aren't rescued soon, families in the region will be too afraid to send their daughters to school. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. The battle for control of territory in eastern Ukraine continued today after a weekend that saw 40 pro-Russian separatists incinerated to death after a building in which they were barricaded was set on fire. Ukraine's Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk blamed his own country's security forces for the loss of life, saying they are incapable of bringing order to the southern city of Odessa. Today, pro-Russian militiamen shot down a Ukrainian helicopter in Slovyansk, where the fighting claimed at least four more lives. On the programme today, the views of one of Vladimir Putin's most outspoken opponents, the chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov, who writes, tweets and speaks about events in Russia, but no longer lives there. He was in the Ugandan capital Kampala over the weekend, promoting the development of chess in schools. And that's where he spoke with FSN's correspondent, Leon Senyange.
I'm out of Russia for more than a year now because I always say that going back home for me will be one-way trip and I have other things to do. So outside of Russia, I currently residing in New York, but most of my time spent in the plane, traveling around the world. It's very dangerous a development, and it's not just about Russia, Ukraine, or even Europe, because we're talking about the collapse of the system of international relations that have been established after 1945. So after World War II, we got, you know, basically to the point where people recognize that trying to redesign the borders, it's a recipe for disaster. Just imagine what will happen in this continent. You start again, this is my border. It's, yes, some borders are not just. But the cost of challenging this, it's insane. So that's why what Putin did in Crimea, it opens Pandora's box. Also, it's very important to point out that the territorial integrity for Ukraine has been guaranteed by the memorandum signed in Budapest 20 years ago in 1994 by United States, United Kingdom and Russia. So there were signatures of Bill Clinton, John Major and Boris Yeltsin on the document. And it was guaranteed in exchange for Ukraine giving up nuclear weapons, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Soviet nukes have been spread in four former republics, Russia proper, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. And Americans justly wanted just all these nukes to be in one country, just to have a normal treaty, and Ukraine gave it up. Now, if you eventually accept the situation where a country which gave up nuclear weapons for territorial integrity has been robbed of part of its territory, you are sending a message to everybody else that nukes are vital for your security. Iran will definitely forget about all the negotiations, but it could go beyond. Look at Japan or South Korea. They are relying exclusively on American military backup. If they don't trust America, so how many months or weeks will it take for Japan to become nuclear? And what kind of tension will create there between Japan, China, South Korea? So I think that, you know, we have to recognize that whether, you know, we are happy or not with certain arrangements, the system of the international relations, the treaties that kept us from major wars for decades must be preserved. And if Russia violated it, the international community must stand firm to push it back. The recognition that Putin's actions in Crimea are threatening the global order is gradually, you know, coming into the minds of Western leaders. Unfortunately, it's just, you know, it's the machine, the political and business machine is working very slowly. And still, you know, Russia, which is an attractive market and has a lot of funds available for businesses, it's quite, you know, a lucrative place for many businesses. So that's why, for instance, German business is dead against any sanctions, which for me gets very troubling because, you know, the German industrialists who are now arguing against sanctions, international sanctions against Putin, they have some, you know, they don't even understand that it resembles the German industrialists who 80 years ago supported another expansionist policy. This is not about Crimea. This is not about Russia. This is about everybody, because you know it's you just start this game, and then you don't know where it could explode, because the chorus about borders, you know, and people of your race, of your religion, of your nationality living across the border. There's so many cases around the world, and the temptation to make sure that this is our country, I mean, could go way beyond Europe.
Gary Kasparov talking to FSN in Kampala, Uganda. Next today, the world of tennis is mourning the death of 30-year-old Elena Baltacha. She passed away over the weekend, just 4 months after being diagnosed with liver cancer. And this evening, she was remembered at a memorial ceremony at the Madrid Open. It's rare for an athlete so strong to succumb so quickly to such a devastating disease. Eleanor Preston is Elena Baltacha's agent.
Cancer, unfortunately, is something which has blighted a lot of lives and touched a lot of lives. And you know, it's a tremendously difficult thing to deal with. It was part of Bali, as she was known, Bali's emotional makeup, that she was always very stoic, never once asked, you know, why me or why is this happening, never once complained about anything. She was incredibly strong and incredibly determined, and you know, that was who she was. She was a very selfless person, very much always, you know, about other people and caring about how other people were coping with it. And that's just, as I say, the sort of personality that she was.
Well, certainly her husband and many people that knew her within the tennis world, speaking of her bravery, she'd been suffering with health issues from a very young age.
Yeah, you know, just to give you some context of what she achieved in her career, she played 11 years representing Great Britain of Fed Cup. She was top 50 in the world, which is an incredible achievement in professional tennis. She was somebody who made the third round of Wimbledon and the Australian Open a couple of times as well. She was somebody who achieved an awful lot, and this was in the context of having a very serious liver condition, which she'd struggled with from the age of 19. And for that reason, she should be held up, you know, as a real role model for everybody, not just for professional athletes and tennis players everywhere, but for everybody, for the way she overcame those obstacles and went on to achieve great things.
Eleanor Preston talking there on Britain's LBC Radio about tennis ace Elena Baltacha, who died over the weekend. To South Africa now, where last-minute campaigning is underway ahead of Wednesday's general election. It sees President Jacob Zuma widely expected to win another term in office at the helm of the African National Congress, the ANC. The election comes as South Africa celebrates 20 years of democracy, and that celebration has been taking place globally, as FSN's Rachel Silverman reports from Berkeley, California.
They sang for Nelson Mandela when he came to California, and now they're singing about him.
Were you there when Mandela was in jail? Were you there?
The kickoff to a two-day event honoring Mandela featured a toast by California Governor Jerry Brown. But the big draw for this crowd, legendary anti-apartheid fighter Albie Sachs, who lost an arm and an eye in a car bombing in 1988 and is today holding forth on 20 years of South African democracy.
Look at what we South Africans can feel so proud about. These are our fifth democratic elections. In the old days, apartheid days, the reactionaries used to say, one man, one vote, once.
During the fight against apartheid, the Berkeley campus played a significant role in the campaign to get universities to divest in companies that did business in South Africa. No surprise, then, that the theme of the Berkeley conference is the hard work of reconciliation, celebrating the legacy of Nelson Mandela. Among the speakers, American Linda Beale, whose daughter Amy died in the violence preceding the elections 20 years ago.
She did encounter a group of young men as they saw her white face coming from a very incited gathering. They decided that they could take her life. So she was stoned and stabbed to death in Guguletu Township on August 25th, 1993.
Ntobeko Penny is one of the men who was convicted of Amy's murder. Beale and Penny embody Mandela's work towards forgiveness and reconciliation. Penny is the program manager for the Beale Family Foundation, helping young people in impoverished South African townships.
Reconciliation takes work. You have to have your heart into it. You have to be ready for that work. It's a journey that does not have guidelines, but we have to be trusting.
So has their example made a difference?
People say it has.
I think we're one of the examples. We're not the only examples. There are hundreds of examples out there, but people who chose to just do things in a quiet way.
Penny and Beale joined Albie Sachs and former prison warden Manfred Jacobs on the Berkeley stage. Reconciliation, forgiveness, the fight for freedom, all the participants opened up with their personal stories. Albie Sachs reflected on the life of a freedom fighter.
It's not a question of sacrifice. Did we achieve the country we wanted? Yes and no. Yes, we've got the Constitution, we have regular elections, we have a free press, we have a strong judiciary. No, we don't have the peace we're entitled to, the personal security. No, we don't have the economic progress.
As South Africa looks ahead to its fifth general elections, those assembled here in Berkeley are honoring Nelson Mandela and remembering the crucial role he played bringing democracy to South Africa. Rachel Silverman, Berkeley, California.
Finally today, FSN Spotlight, and today it shines on the accessibility of global culture. If you've been to an exhibition in any American city lately, you'll know the eagerness with which museums seek to draw crowds, provide interaction, and in many cases, secure donations from visitors. That's become the hallmark of modern cultural institutions, but not so much, it seems, in France. Peter Aspden, an arts writer with the Financial Times, offers these thoughts on a recent trip to the French city of Nice.
Some light drizzle rudely interrupted this column's annual foray to the south of France to view the wondrous cultural phenomenon that is Stanislas Wawrinka's topspin backhand at the Monte Carlo Masters. But help was at hand. The splendour of the Hotel Negresco on Nice's Promenade des Anglais. The unmistakable pink-domed edifice is one of the region's landmarks and seemed the perfect haven in which to spend a languorous hour waiting for the sunshine to reassert itself. I was even ready to overlook the hotel's weirdly ungrammatical slogan, Made in French Riviera, in exchange for a high-end cappuccino and some shelter from the storm. Turns out grammar was the least of my problems. I went to the reception area, in which a kind staff member directed me to the hotel's brasserie, La Rotonde. I jogged round the corner, only to be met by a dark-voiced Charybdis guarding her dominion with improbable zeal. Fermé, she snapped. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. Impossible, I retorted, as I pointed to the dormant crocodile of my Lacoste shirt, de rigueur in these parts, and mimed that I was here for Stanislas Wawrinka's backhand, which made next to no impression, and may even have looked like an attempt at assault. I trudged away, but found fresh hope in spying another imposing building next door, the Villa Massena, complete with its own museum. I poked my head round the corner. Was there a café in the extremely large house? The attendant looked at me as if I had asked him to split the atom with me on the beach across the road. A ticket? He asked, pseudo-helpfully. No, a coffee. We stared at each other for a while. I may have said something unprintable and certainly ungrammatical. Coffee notwithstanding, I asked him if he had a brochure that explained what was in the museum. A contemptuous shrug of the shoulders and a curt non. The crocodile and I left the house and walked forlornly away, unloved, unwanted. They took me by surprise, these sullen reactions. I guess the seemingly inelastic demand for luxury hotels means that they can afford to behave imperiously. Indeed, it may be that they are one of the last bastions of shamelessly non-democratic behaviour in a world that is filling itself with a brand of nouvelle richesse that was not even dreamt of just a couple of decades ago. But a place of culture? Not to be chauvinistic, but it is, in my experience, inconceivable for an arts institution in Britain today to behave with anything that smacks of high-handedness. Such has been the near obsessive concern with the democratisation and accessibility of culture in recent years that it is almost taken for granted. Here is what we now expect: coffee bars, souvenir shops, outreach programmes, interactive spaces, digital strategies, and a degree of politesse, yes, a French word, among customer service staff that is mostly a genuine pleasure to behold. Far from making visitors feel uncomfortable, it's the job of today's cultural institution to reach out to them in new ways. On June the 3rd, there will be a live broadcast to about 100 UK cinemas, as well as 30 worldwide, of Tate Modern's new blockbuster exhibition, Henri Matisse, The Cutouts, following similar initiatives based on the National Gallery's 2012 Leonardo exhibition and last year's British Museum show on Pompeii. When you reach out, people reach back in unpredictable ways. The promotional trailer by the BM on its current Vikings exhibition is being satirised, I learnt this week, by the Reclaim Shakespeare Company, an environmental group which objects to the show's sponsorship by BP. Mildly embarrassing for the company and the museum, but terrific for the rest of us to see important ethical debates bursting out into new and lively forums that can be freely accessed by millions. It's the sign of a robust and confident cultural landscape. It was only a matter of time, of course, before artists began to comment on this very relationship between the public and private domains of culture. The latest piece of street art by Banksy, Mobile Lovers, which appeared in a doorway near Bristol's Broad Plain Boys Club earlier this month, has been the subject of a fascinating tussle between the club and the City Council, which has installed it in the Bristol City Museum. Where does it really belong? Will it end up in an auction house? Banksy is keeping his counsel, understanding that the proprietorial riddles he sets us are a far more sophisticated comment on the world than the rather trite points he makes in the artworks themselves. When art bleeds into the streets, it asks the most important questions of all. Whom should culture belong to? What is it trying to say to us? And where can I get a coffee while I think about it?
Peter Aspden of the Financial Times. You can read his coverage of arts and culture and hear more from him and a host of other Financial Times writers by visiting the newspaper's website, ft.com. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Get in touch with us by email, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. Kevin McAleese is back in the hot seat tomorrow. I'm Simon Marks, alongside Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.